Erev Tov and Chodesh Tov. Welcome back to The Present and the Jews, part 21, discussing tonight the presidency of Richard Milhouse Nixon. With a middle name like that, you're not going to get far. All right, it's the second of the year tonight. We're sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'il Nishmas Yonah ben Rab Aryeh Leib. Well, it's hard to escape the conclusion that Richard Nixon was one of the weirdest men ever to serve as president. So he had his demons. He was, including now, he had his demons. He was brilliant, but he was peculiar in a way that was atypical for politicians. He was moody, brooding, aloof, a bit of a loner. He was not very warm in private. He was always very guarded, very calculating. He was uncomfortable around people, which is rare for a politician. Very awkward with small talk, socially off. At the state dinners, he would always sit on the end. So maximum, he would have to talk to one person. And even then, he would have the staff remove someone after 5 minutes, figuring he couldn't sustain a conversation for more than that. That famous picture of Nixon walking on the beach in San Clemente in a suit and dress shoes was not a one-time event. It was a routine. And his home, I saw it last summer, his home was on a cliff, isolated from society, from the rest of San Clemente. So he could be warm with his family, but he could also be emotionally distant from them. Nixon paid for his crimes, as no president ever did before or after. And he was caught up for sure in an adverse way in the spirit of the times. I mean, the ground shifted beneath him in a way to which he was not sensitive. The culture and mores of American society, especially the media and the public, which was discontented at the time, changed dramatically while he was president, and he did not adjust. He was somewhat bewildered by it. He attributed much of the opposition to him, just animosity towards him, and there's plenty of that, but he didn't really get it, ever. I'm of the opinion that he paid a heavy and natural price for his crimes, universal disgrace, the only president ever to resign from office. Even though there's nothing that he did that was not done by his predecessors. Now, it doesn't make it right, but it just makes it minog hamedino, or minog hasocharim, or minog hapolitikaim. He used the IRS to harass his enemies. So did FDR. So did JFK. For that matter, so has Obama used the FBI to harass his enemies. In fact, Bobby Kennedy had Nixon audited several times after 1960, try to keep him from running again. He lied about the conduct of the war in Vietnam that he inherited. Yeah, so did JFK and LBJ. For that matter, we're not being told the truth about American troops in Iraq and the Middle East today. He taped people in the Oval Office without their knowledge. So has every president from FDR through Obama. The only difference is that Nixon's taping system was voice activated, and every other president had the good sense to activate it with a manual switch or deactivate it with a manual switch so as to record what they want to record as opposed to recording everything. He kept enemies' lists and punished his enemies and used dirty tricks against them. Yeah, like every president since the 19th century. He covered up the crimes of his subordinates. Duh. Every president does that until today. In fact, this administration, not to get too political, but it has a very sorry record of investigating scandals, crimes, cover-ups. You look at the 18.5-minute gap in one of the tapes and compare that with 30,000 Hillary Clinton emails that were deleted, or all of Lois Lerner's IRS emails deleted or attempted to delete. So the Nixon, in fact, influenced political life in a way that he probably anticipated but would never articulate. People would learn from his mistakes. In the 1960s, the mainstream media became overtly left-wing, anti-government, something less than patriotic. And they always hated Nixon as an anti-communist since the 1940s, the late 1940s. It was Nixon who told the press in 1962, after losing the California gubernatorial race, announcing he was dropping out of politics, "You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore." Boy, was he wrong about that. And people really hated Nixon in a way that I think was unprecedented. It sounds strange. People hated FDR as well, but Nixon was the first president to suffer from the type of obsessive, deranged hatred that has now unfortunately become the norm in American society. Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton had opponents, for example, but hatred of them wasn't widespread. You go, though, to George Bush Jr. and Obama, and for that matter, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, people really despise them, rightly or wrongly. And it was that type of antipathy, so common today, but so unusual in the past, that plagued Richard Nixon. And what makes it even stranger in retrospect is that before his world fell apart, Nixon was one of the most popular presidents ever, winning re-election in 1972 by 61-37%, winning 49 out of 50 states, almost running the table. There's only one other president who ever did that, aside from Monroe, ran unopposed and wasn't 50 states. Who's that? Ronald Reagan, 1984, also won 49 out of 50 states. Nixon lost Massachusetts. Reagan lost Minnesota. Less than 18 months before his resignation, Nixon's approval rating was 68%. And then it went south pretty quickly. What's even more fascinating to us is that he harbored anti-Jewish prejudices quite openly, and not uncommon in his day. He blamed Jews for his problems and for his demise. Although I think in retrospect, I don't want to defend him too much, but I think he almost always used Jew as a synonym for liberal, and he was not far off in that. And yet he did not hesitate to have Jews in his inner circle. And what's most stunning, and why Jews should have a little more appreciation than Richard Nixon than most ever did, is that he overruled one of those Jews and helped Israel during one of the most difficult periods of Israel's existence. So Yesh Kona Olamo B'Shachas, the people acquire their share of eternal life because of what they did at one time, one moment, one situation. It's as if his entire life led to that decision, after which his decline was precipitous and the end of his presidency beckoned. So let's go back to the beginning. Nixon was a classic rags-to-riches story. You visit the Nixon Library in Yorba Linda, California, where he was born and raised and is now buried. And I've been there, I think, 5 or 6 times. David's been there 12, 18 times already. It's actually sad. You can't look at his life and not feel sad from beginning to end. He was born January 9th, 1913, and he grew up poor. How poor? He didn't have shoes until he was 7 years old. And he, until second or third grade, he would come to school barefoot, and he was subject to the ridicule and taunts of his classmates. His parents were Quakers, very humble, very restrained, very staid. His father was semi-literate, quick to anger, struggled to earn a living. His mother was quite stoic, and he always praised her as a saint. And they had to be. 2 brothers of his died of illness, and not in their infancy. One when he was 12, one when he was 20, and the grief really never left the family. And yet, in his 8th grade yearbook, it is on display in the museum, he wrote, "I would like to study law and enter politics for an occupation so that I might be of some good to the people." And in fact, that became his lifelong objective, which he realized. Nixon was always stiff in public. He was a poor athlete. He was an amateur actor, but not a very good one either. He attended Whittier College because even though he had a tuition scholarship to Yale and could have applied for one to Harvard, his family just could not afford the travel expenses to the East Coast or the living expenses for him to go east. So because of that and other reasons, Nixon always had a healthy hatred for Harvard. And yet, he had more Harvard advisors than even the Harvard presidents had serving him, including Henry Kissinger, who was his first foreign affairs advisor, and Daniel Patrick Moynihan, his first domestic affairs advisor. After college, one of the happiest days of his life, he received a full scholarship to Duke Law School. And when he came to North Carolina, first time really traveled anywhere, he was overwhelmed by the majesty of the buildings and the environment in which he found himself. And it's not known, Nixon had a kind and tender heart, and you read about him, and again, people change, people have dark sides also, but we should never overlook the other side. One of his classmates in law school had polio, and Nixon every day would wait for him and help carry him up the stairs to his class. There was no such thing as handicap access back then. And he was troubled by segregation when he saw it for the first time in North Carolina. He'd never experienced it in California. Whittier is like an hour's drive east of Los Angeles. And he was annoyed that no one spoke against it. And he, in fact, did speak against it. And throughout his life, he always had a special empathy for those who were downtrodden or troubled, politicians who had lost, people had been disgraced. For example, I read the other day, he wrote a letter to the son of Thomas Eagleton. You remember the name in his reelection. George McGovern nominated first as his vice presidential running mate, Senator Eagleton from Missouri. And he had to drop out after 3 days because of mental issues that he had. Not that that should be a bar for the presidency, by the way, but nonetheless. Nixon wrote to his son that summer, son was 13 years old, that he should be proud of his father. Proud, he said, of his courage, poise, and just plain guts. The boy was 13 years old, never forgot it, showed it to his father, who said, we're going to have a hard time opposing him now. And of course, the letter was never publicized until, you know, long after Nixon died. And there are hundreds of examples like this. He even reached out to Teddy Kennedy privately after Chappaquiddick. And then, of course, he spied on him to try to get even more dirt on him. But nonetheless, he never used that against Ted Kennedy. After law school, Nixon was rejected by fancy New York law firms. It's a grudge he also harbored for decades. Then he went back to Whittier. He worked for a law firm. He joined an amateur acting group where he was cast in a play opposite an attractive girl named Patricia Ryan. So he was interested in her immediately, she less so. For 3 nights, he tagged along, got a lift home in a car in which she got a lift as well, being very awkward. On the third night, he asked her for a date, and she laughed. And he said, don't laugh, someday I'm going to marry you. And it made no impression on her. That love went unrequited for a long time. But he would hang around her to the extent, and he always was, from his youth, he was insecure. That was one of his problems. To be with her, he would drive her to dates with other men, all right? Drive her in his car from Whittier to Los Angeles to meet other men. He would wait for her in the car and drive her back. He was 25 then, he wasn't young, just to be with her. After 2 years, he finally grew on her, and they agreed to marry. And their backgrounds were actually quite similar. She also came from a poor family, except that her father, unlike his, was a hard drinker, something that would plague Pat Nixon her whole life. Now, how much Nixon drank is a subject of great debate. My own conclusion, just from doing the readings, is that he didn't drink much. It wasn't like his wife. He didn't drink much, but he couldn't hold his liquor. And even after one drink, he was wobbly, and after two, he was plastered. So that gave people the impression that he was always drunk. In fact, he just couldn't hold his liquor. They married in 1940 when World War II broke out. Nixon, to the horror of his Quaker mother, remember they're all pacifists, enlisted in the Navy. He became a lieutenant, but he never saw combat. First posted in Iowa, which is a good place for Navy, I guess. And then as an air transport officer on a base in the South Pacific. Now, just as well, he always got seasick whenever they sailed. So he's not the ideal naval officer. After the way he returned to Whittier to practice law, he was recruited in 1946 to run as Republican against the incumbent Democrat politician. And Nixon was young, fresh-faced, he was a veteran, and with the country turning against the New Deal and beset by unemployment, especially for returning veterans, he proceeded to paint his opponent as out of touch. And he won and entered Congress, controlled by the Republicans, 1946, the same year as JFK, whom he would run against in 1960. In 1948, they were joined by Gerald Ford, who would succeed Nixon in 1974. But he was not warm or amiable enough to make friends easily, so he focused on policy and learning about the issues, and he became quite proficient. Ironically, Nixon became close to John F. Kennedy, and he wrote about Kennedy that the two of them had a lot in common. You wouldn't think of it that way. JFK said was also not a back-slapping type. He had also lost a brother. Nixon had lost two. And Kennedy was also shy, Nixon said, for the opposite reason than he was. He was shy because he was poor and insecure. Kennedy was shy because he was wealthy and always thought people wanted to take advantage of him. Nixon wrote of traveling one overnight on a train with Kennedy in the late 1940s, bunk beds, and they stayed up all night debating foreign policy, called the first Kennedy-Nixon debate. They were unlike in another way also. Nixon served on a committee in Congress in 1947. He joined the committee in visiting Europe and assessing the Marshall Plan, what was needed, where to spend the money, etc. So it was a business trip. No wives were invited, no fancy dinners. Kennedy didn't go. It wasn't his committee. But as a gesture of friendship, he gave Nixon the names and addresses of three women in Paris that Nixon should look up. Well, his secretary later wrote that Nixon was so embarrassed when he got the list, he didn't even take the names with him, didn't know what to do with it. He was a square in that sense, or at least moral, and for all his other scandals, Nixon at least was a faithful husband, something you can't really say about many of his predecessors. Soon after that trip ended, Nixon became embroiled in one of the first controversies of his life, one that would propel him to prominence. He served on the House Un-American Affairs Committee, designed to ferret out communists from the government. They heard testimony from Whittaker Chambers, who named Alger Hiss as a former communist agent. That Chambers was more or less unknown, but Hiss was a Harvard law graduate who had been a high-ranking official in the State Department. Hiss testified, very patrician, denied the allegation, and the committee, except for Nixon, was ready to believe him. But Nixon persisted, like a dog with a bone, until evidence emerged on microfilm, it was called the Pumpkin Papers, that in fact Hiss had been a communist. The papers, the microfilm, had copies of papers that Hiss had passed to Chambers in the 1930s when Chambers was openly a member of the Communist Party. And Hiss had denied ever knowing Chambers. Well, Hiss was convicted of perjury, went to jail protesting his innocence, and Nixon's world really collapsed then. The best evidence we have since the Soviet Union fell is that indeed Hiss was a Soviet agent. The immediate effect, though, was to make Nixon a hero to a few and a pariah, even a monster to others, especially the mainstream media. And that would never change. Nixon was elected to the Senate in 1950, defeating Helen Gehagen Douglas, who was a paramour of LBJ, beat her by 20 points. In the campaign, Nixon hinted that she, too, might be a communist. She certainly had a far-left voting record. Nixon picked up the Senate seat and something else that would trail him the rest of his life, the nickname Tricky Dick. She called him that, but she also accused Nixon of being soft on communism, something that's not widely known. It was a type of slurry just hurled at people back then. And very interestingly, JFK gave Nixon a check for $1,000 for his campaign from his father, Joe Kennedy, who admired Nixon's anti-communism, for which he was widely known. And then, within a very short time, Eisenhower nominated Nixon to be his vice president in 1952 after much hesitation. And Nixon had a few things in his favor. He was young, really young. He was 39 at the time. I mean, even Dan Quayle was much older than that. He was young, he was a veteran, he was anti-communist, And he was from California as well, already a growing state, and the Republicans were interested in attracting those electoral votes. In both elections, 1952 and 1956, the Republicans would carry California and its 32 electoral votes. And for all of Nixon's later notoriety and infamy, it bears mentioning that there are only two people in American history who ran for the highest national offices five times, each of them winning four races. One is Franklin Roosevelt, won four times as president after losing the vice presidential race in 1920. And the second is Richard Nixon, who won twice as vice president, twice as president, and lost in 1960. So that can't happen unless there's some real popularity among the people, which again, in retrospect, is very strange. But with popularity came also intense unpopularity. And as both his daughters, Julia and Tricia, later wrote, how difficult it was for them to live through his vilification, which really went on for 25, 30 years. In the 1952 campaign, he was accused of having access to a fund, about $18,000 in all, put together by his supporters the year before to pay his political expenses that his enemies alleged was a kickback and bribery scheme. Nixon went on national television to save his place on the ticket September 23rd, 1952. It's the largest TV audience until then. 60 million people watched him that night, more than saw the finale of Friends, if that means anything to you, with a much larger audience. And Nixon denied that he used even a nickel for personal expenses. He said, quite memorably, "I would say this, that Pat doesn't have a mink coat, but she does have a respectable Republican cloth coat. And I always tell she looked good in anything." And she sat nearby, beaming. It was the first time you had those images on television of the faithful, smiling wife behind the politician. And Nixon added that a supporter in Texas heard that his two girls wanted a dog, and they'd sent a package to them that they picked up at Union Station in Baltimore. I continue. "It was a little Cocker Spaniel dog in a crate that he'd sent all the way from Texas, black and white spotted. And our little girl, Tricia, the six-year-old, named it Checkers. And you know, the kids, like all kids, love the dog. And I just want to say this right now, that regardless of what they say about it, we're going to keep it." Now, the reaction to that speech ranged from contemptuous to supportive. It was one of the greatest political performances in history. Back in California, his acting coach in high school watched and said, "That's my boy, that's my boy." But Eisenhower kept him on the ticket, so he appealed to the most important audience, and the story died for several reasons, including the discovery, not long after that, that Adlai Stevenson, who was Eisenhower's opponent, had a similar fund that was valued not at $18,000, but at $146,000, and he had used it for personal expenses. But nonetheless, the story died. It was still very hard on his family. Eisenhower used Nixon extensively as vice president, more than most, certainly more than Kennedy would use LBJ. Nixon attended all cabinet meetings, toured around the world, and began to hone his foreign affairs skills. I should note, Eisenhower felt that the vice president should always be in a position to step in right away, that he had seen the transfer from Roosevelt to Truman as not an altogether healthy one for the society. So he made him literally the vice president, and he used him as a hammer also, even having Nixon fire Eisenhower's longtime friend, Chief of Staff Sherman Adams, who was caught up in an influence peddling scandal in which his wife received a fancy coat from one Bernard Goldfein. See? Jew. A manufacturer. Now, even though there was talk that Eisenhower should drop Nixon in 1956, he didn't, and so he was a natural candidate for president in 1960. We discussed last week, ran against his old Senate colleague, JFK. Nixon became the first president, for the first candidate, but the first president ever to visit all 50 states. Never been done before. And he was defeated in a breathtakingly close election. He didn't challenge the outcome, even after it was clear that votes were stolen. In some Chicago districts, there were more JFK votes than there were registered voters in the district. All right. By the way, same thing happened in Philadelphia in 2008 and 2012 in Obama's two races. When Nixon ran and lost more votes emerging from a district than there were actual voters registered there, and by the thousands. But he was plotting a comeback. He seemed his career was over when he lost the California governor's race. But he planned to come back. He moved to New York, joined the law firm Mudge Rose, and he began his campaign late 1967. His main opponent for the nomination was George Romney, Mitt's father, although Nelson Rockefeller and Ronald Reagan were also in the mix. And we recall the year 1968 was one of the most turbulent in American history. The liberals had turned against the Vietnam War. Youth challenged both the war and the traditional morality of their parents. The Democrats were immersed in turmoil. Cities were on fire. Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy were both assassinated. The Democrat convention in Chicago descended into chaos, rioting in the streets, police brutality, with Abe Ribicoff, the Connecticut senator, denouncing on public television the Chicago police for their Gestapo tactics. That's the word that he used. In the audience was Richard Daley, the mayor, screaming at Ribicoff, "Go home, you Jew SOB." And all of this was televised. George Wallace ran as a third-party candidate, and he won five states. This election was also very close. Nixon defeated Hubert Humphrey by 500,000 votes, 43.4%. to 42.7%, which was a landslide compared to 1960, 301 to 191 in the Electoral College. Wallace won 13.5% of the vote, and Richard Nixon became the 37th president. Putting Watergate aside, that was strange. It always reminds me, it's like, you know, the old joke, other than that, how did you enjoy the play, Mrs. Lincoln? Well, again, putting aside Watergate for a moment, Nixon was not at all a conservative president, and to a great extent, he expanded government control of the economy and intruded even more on the private sector. It was Nixon who imposed wage and price controls on the economy to cope with inflation in 1971. It was Nixon who ended the convertibility of the dollar into gold. It had been fixed at $35 an ounce. Now it fluctuates. It was Nixon who increased government spending to stimulate the economy, saying famously, "We are all Keynesians now." It was Nixon who created the Environmental Protection Agency, haunts us until today, OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It was Nixon who passed the Clean Air Act. Nixon really was an environmental president. It was Nixon who proposed a workfare program, even called it workfare, to get people off welfare 25 years before it was enacted in the Clinton administration, but his Congress rejected it. And Nixon even supported the Equal Rights Amendment when it was first proposed in the late 1960s. But bear in mind that Nixon had to deal with a Congress that was overwhelmingly Democrat, and he was enough of a pragmatist to try to get things done. In fact, remember also, Nixon was the one who ended the draft in 1973, which took a lot of the wind out of the sails of the youth anti-war movement. But Nixon's main interest was always foreign affairs. In fact, he always felt that domestically, aside from some tinkering, a country could run itself. Not so foreign relations. And he inherited the Vietnam War. He tried to win, then he tried to disengage, often threatened to bomb the North into oblivion, but the North knew they could just wait out American society, and they did. Nixon kept his own counsel, but he appointed as his national security advisor Henry Kissinger. Kissinger actually supported Rockefeller during the campaign. The two of them formulated American foreign policy for a decade, and to a large extent, it's still influential today. Kissinger was another strange duck. Born into a religious family, moved to the Heights as a 15-year-old refugee, served with distinction in the American Army, even seen combat in the Battle of the Bulge. And because he spoke German, you know, he never lost the accent because he's always very shy, just like Nixon. But because he spoke a fluent German, he was brought into the intelligence corps. And after the war, within 8 years, He graduated Harvard with a BA, a master's, and a PhD. And Kissinger came to Nixon's attention already in 1960 and remained an advisor to him. He is brilliant, but we'll get to some of his dark side later on. Together they tried and failed to negotiate an end to the Vietnam War. Kissinger won a Nobel Peace Prize for negotiating a ceasefire with the North, but obviously it collapsed, and his Nobel remains a peace prize similar to the one that Arafat, Rabin, and Peres won for the Oslo Accords. Together, Nixon and Kissinger opened the door to relations with communist China, shocking Nixon supporters who saw him as anti-communist. But they saw relations with China as a good counterweight to the Soviet Union playing one against the other, and they did it masterfully. In fact, they changed human history because of that. You had China brought back into the family of nations, and the Cold War essentially thawed under Nixon. There'd be no brinksmanship from then really until today, except for one event. With the Soviets, they embarked on a policy of détente, meaning a relaxation of tensions, gradually increasing economic and other ties in the hope of improving relations. This was not completely successful, nor was it moral, as it essentially acquiesced in the repression of the Soviet regime. And this will lead to clashes with Jewish groups who began pressing for human rights and the emigration of Soviet Jews. We'll look at Kissinger's role a little later, why he remains a controversial figure until today. The many Jews who revile him, and others, including himself, who've attempted to whitewash his record and construe his actions as favorable to Jews. Nixon had a tough time with Jews. And yet, again, context is everything. It seems he had no contact with any Jews for decades growing up. And he had a very low opinion of Jews generally, but he seemed a low opinion of many different groups. Now, this is borne out by the Oval Office recordings, many of which sound shocking, but also require context. He comes off very often as a sort of angry Don Rickles. By our standards today, he'd be defined as a Jew hater, but he didn't really care for most groups. So he's heard complaining on a number of recordings about the number of Jews in government, in media, elsewhere. Complained to Bob Haldeman, chief of staff, the Jews are all over the government, and we'd be better off if these agencies were not controlled by Jews. Washington, I quote, is full of Jews. Most Jews are disloyal and can't be trusted. They turn on you. Am I wrong or right? Another time he said he was not prejudiced at all. In fact, in 1960, he and his entourage left a hotel in Springfield, Missouri, when the hotel refused to allow the black reporters to stay there, something Kennedy's campaign did not do. But here, he said he's not prejudiced, and then he went on to say, the Jews have certain traits. The Irish have certain traits. For example, the Irish can't drink. What you always have to remember with the Irish is they get mean. Virtually every Irish I've known gets mean when he drinks, particularly the real Irish. The Italians, of course, those people don't have their heads screwed on tight. They're wonderful people, but, and then a moment later got back to the Jews are just a very aggressive and abrasive and obnoxious personality. Now, perhaps nowhere is his muddled approach to Jews more on display than in this nugget. He was discussing potential judicial nominees with an aide, and Nixon said, no Jews. Is that clear? We've got enough Jews. Now, if you find some Jew I think is great, put him on there. So it means, again, he was conflating Jew and liberals, a particular type of Jew that he didn't like, but in fact, those Jews were the majority of Jews, and those ones who caused him all these troubles. And he saw that group as his antagonists. Often he would ask if a particular enemy of his was a Jew, and often find out that they were not, and was befuddled by it. Daniel Ellsberg, for example. So his parents were Jewish, but they converted to Christian Science. He was not raised as a Jew at all. And yet for all that, he surrounded himself with Jews. Kissinger, for one, when he went to work for Mudge Rose, he befriended a partner named Leonard Garment, and they remained close for decades. Garment became a special consultant and then active in the Watergate defense, even White House counsel after John Dean. And when he lived in New York, Nick was very often a guest in Garman's home in Brooklyn Heights. And Garman was a staunch liberal, but nonetheless, he was a friend. William Safire, famously one of his primary speechwriters. Milton Friedman, Alan Greenspan, the economist, not the dermatologist. They both became informal economic advisors. Then he had formal advisors. Arthur Burns, chair of the Fed. Herb Stein, chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. He's the father of Ben Stein, you know, the comedian, the actor, the writer. And Ben Stein also worked in the Nixon White House. And by the same token, he tapped the phones of Kissinger and Safire and many, many others, as had Johnson had done, and Kennedy as well, because he didn't fully trust them and he was obsessed about leaks. It was Safire, actually, who went from the White House to the Times, who understood the way politics was created, and he developed the meme of calling every scandal X-gate, all right? Starting with Lancegate, you know, Burt Lance, down to Deflategate and Tom Brady, to show that corruption was endemic to Washington, not just Nixon, if not to society generally. Nixon once said of Kissinger and Safire that they're both compensating for an inferiority complex. I quote Nixon, "What it is, it's the insecurity. It's the latent insecurity. Most Jewish people are insecure, and that's why they have to prove things." Could be true. What's ironic and most revealing is that it's even more true of Richard Nixon himself. And he was quite insecure and always having to prove himself. When he finished the Checkers speech and they won the election in 1952, his mother sent him a note, "Richard, I'm proud I am of you," etc. And he kept the note in his wallet to the end of his life. Think about it. Nixon breached the informal custom of the Jewish seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. When Abe Fortas resigned, Nixon nominated two individuals in a row, both rejected. The second, Harold Carswell, the segregationist, was deemed mediocre by the Bar Association, prompting Senator Roman Rusko, one of the great quotes of all time, from Nebraska to state, "He's mediocre." There are a lot of mediocre lawyers and people and judges. They're entitled to a little representation, aren't they? There would not be another Jewish justice on the Supreme Court until Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 1993, and now they're just too many. Nixon was also close with Walter Annenberg of TV Guide fame, whom he appointed ambassador to Britain, and of course, longtime Republican donor Max Fisher. And Nixon genuinely admired Golda Meir as the prime minister for most of his tenure. She was tough and shrewd, and again, vintage Nixon. You get the feeling that at a certain point, he forgot he was being recorded. But planning the state dinner for Golda Meir, Nixon called it the Jewish dinner. He's told Rosemary Wood, be famous for the 18-minute gap in the tapes, but was his secretary for 20 years, going back to the 1950. Nixon said to Rosemary Woods, "I don't want any Jew at that dinner who didn't support us in that campaign. Is that clear? No Jew who did not support us." Well, seeing as he got 17% of the vote, the Jewish vote, in 1968, Humphrey got 82%, Nixon got more than Goldwater's 10% in 1964, it sounds like it was a very sparsely attended dinner, or maybe the seats were filled with Gentiles. Well, Nixon comes into our world in two major areas. First, Soviet Jewry. So what did Richard Nixon do about Soviet Jewry? The issue really mushroomed under his watch, especially with the trial of the Leningrad 16, who attempted in June 1970 to hijack a plane from St. Petersburg, fly to Finland. They were arrested before the plane took off, sentenced to death. Some were sentenced to death. Mark Dipschitz. Well, no one was executed in the end. Well, a famous name still came to shul a few years ago. Yosef Mendelevich was the youngest of the conspirators. It was after this that SSSJ, Student Struggle Soviet Jewry, stepped up its activities. The JDL began to harass Soviet diplomats. The first Solidarity Sunday was 1972. But truth be told, Nixon had other fish to fry. Nixon and Kissinger negotiated the first SALT treaty, Strategic Arms Limitation Talks with the Soviets, which limited nuclear weapons. And the truth is, they played the Soviets off the Chinese like geniuses, and they changed history that way. The Soviets did moderate their behavior over time. It was not a single episode of Cold War brinksmanship, really, from then until today, except when the Soviets mobilized their nuclear forces during the Yom Kippur War. But other than that, Nixon's relations with Brezhnev did thaw the Cold War. It liberated China. And really, you see, China now becomes a major economic competitor to the United States in the last decade and a half, where it was a backwoods until Nixon's time. Concomitantly, neither Nixon nor Kissinger took an active interest in the plight of Soviet Jewry, and indeed the opposite was true. Aside from the occasional statement in support of human rights for Jews, U.S. raised the issue, for example, at the UN in 1969, but for propaganda purposes, Nixon favored stability with the Soviets over challenging them for their repression and trying to pressure them to let Jews emigrate. And for a time, we have to be honest, the thaw worked. And Nixon's approach worked also. In the 1960s, a whole decade, 4,000 Jews were allowed to leave the Soviet Union. In the 1970s, 250,000 left. And after a huge surge of emigration in 70, 71, and 72, the number dropped to a trickle because the Soviets imposed a prohibitive exit tax, a ransom tax, for Jews to leave even after. And Jews began to be fired and or imprisoned for applying to emigrate. Nixon did meet with Jewish leaders and urged them to trust him and his quiet diplomacy. By the early 1970s, an average of 25,000-30,000 Jews were emigrating every year. But to the Jews, there was a principle at stake, which is quite understandable, as well as the human dimension, the principle of free movement of human rights. But that didn't really move Nixon. And he was anxious to bring the Soviets into the family of nations through trade by not embarrassing them. So he and Kissinger opposed, for example, the Jackson-Vanik Amendment that restricted trade with nations that did not adhere to basic principles of human rights, especially emigration. This was the brainchild of Richard Perle, who was an aide to Senator Henry Scoop Jackson, a Hasid Umos HaOlam, who's a hawkish Democrat, a breed that has become extinct. Jackson was pro-Israel to the core, one of the founders, in retrospect, of neoconservatism. So this amendment was not adapted until Ford's administration, but because it was adopted, the Soviets closed the spigot. 1975, so now you're averaging 30,000 emigrants a year. 75, it was down to 13,000. And again, to win favor with Jimmy Carter, it was pumped up to 50,000 in 1979, and then by 81, it dropped down again. Well, you have this nugget, which is almost difficult to read, much less to listen to. It was taped in the Oval Office after Golda Meir visited Nixon in 1972 and asked for his active help in winning freedom for Soviet Jewry. Israelis always saw the Aliyah angle also, even if it didn't necessarily work out that way. So, in the Oval Office, Nixon and Kissinger. Here's Kissinger, I quote, imagine a German accent. The emigration of Jews from the Soviet Union is not an objective of American foreign policy. And if they put Jews into gas chambers in the Soviet Union, it is not an American concern. Maybe a humanitarian concern. And Nixon responded, I know, we can't blow up the world because of it. It's one of the colder, more calculating, even repugnant things that either man ever said, but to them, everything was realpolitik, pragmatism in the pursuit of diplomatic objectives. And of course, Israel. Now, Nixon inherited an Israel that was confident in the wake of the Six-Day War, an Israel that had just begun to receive U.S. weaponry and needed from America mainly diplomatic support. Kissinger was basically uninvolved in Middle East diplomacy through much of the first term, focusing on the Soviets and the Chinese. Into that vacuum stepped the hapless and often bypassed Secretary of State William Rogers, who proposed the Rogers Plan in 1969 to end the war of attrition and reach a new armistice agreement between Egypt and Israel. It's a call for Israel to withdraw completely from the Sinai in exchange for peace. Both sides rejected it, and Israel knew from a back channel, who was Kissinger, that neither Nixon nor Kissinger were that invested in Rogers or his plan. The Israeli ambassador was Yitzhak Rabin. He was able to mobilize American Jews against the Rogers plan. Rogers did negotiate a ceasefire to the War of Attrition in 1970 that both sides accepted, 1970 in August, which so angered the PLO that it went to war against King Hussein and were massacred. That's Black September. At the end of that month, Gamal Nasser died suddenly. His successor, Anwar el-Sadat, would launch the Yom Kippur War together with Syria October 6, 1973. Now, there had been much bellicose talk emanating from Egypt for months, as well as a military buildup, but the intelligence in Israel was in conflict. And we know blunders were made, many out of hubris, warning signs were missed. Exacerbating the problem was the position of the U.S. Both Nixon and Kissinger warned Israel not to attack first, partly because the CIA was predicting that there would be no war. And it was a warning that was repeated as late as Yom Kippur morning. I have in my hand this declassified document. We'll see in a moment that Kissinger will later deny this, but this was from the White House Situation Room. It was declassified 15 years ago. The morning of the war, to the situation from Henry Kissinger, and he says, among other things, "We are urgently communicating with the Israelis, warning them against any preemptive attack." And then he says at the end, so it's a longer piece, he was assured by Israel there would be no preemptive attack. "I told them that since this message was passed to us, we would oppose any preemptive strikes," he told the foreign minister of Egypt and of the Soviets. And Kissinger admitted in the same document, "On the basis of the information we have, I believe the Israeli fears of a possible attack are justified." And nonetheless, he told them not to preempt. The threat was reiterated. Golda Meir failed to launch a preemptive strike. It was General David Elazar, the chief of staff, who called for that strike. He was denied, and he wound up with the most blame for the war. And the war was devastating. The Bar-Lev line was overrun almost immediately. The Golan Heights were completely retaken, the first days of the war. Casualties were grievous, ultimately totaling more than 2,700 Israeli soldiers killed. And the CIA got this wrong also. They predicted Israel would be victorious within 72 hours. Israeli POWs by the hundreds were tortured and some killed as well. On October 9th, Israel made an emergency request for an airlift of supplies from the United States, tanks, aircraft, ammunition, etc. Shortly before that, Israel had begun preliminary steps to prepare for the use of nuclear weapons to thwart the enemy. But it never came to that. Israel counterattacked, repulsed the enemy on both fronts, capturing large swaths of territory inside Egypt and inside Syria and encircling the Egyptian Third Army. That counterattack was only possible because Israel knew that American supplies would be coming. And therein lies another story, shrouded in self-serving gobbledygook. Golda Meir appealed directly to Nixon, who approved it, probably for two reasons. Although he still smarted from the failure of Jews to support him in 1972, his share of the Jewish vote in 72 did increase. It doubled to 35%, a higher percentage really than Romney, McCain, or George W. Bush ever received. But primarily, Nixon saw Israel as a bulwark against the Soviets, and the Soviets were rearming their allies. And with all the problems in Vietnam, he could not afford to have another U.S. ally humbled or defeated. So Nixon had a grudge against American Jews, but nonetheless, he was looking to hurt the Soviets even more. He ran into two obstacles. The Secretary of Defense, James Schlesinger, who was a Jewish convert to Christianity, a Jew had converted to Christianity. He opposed the airlift on the grounds it might inflame the Soviets. And Kissinger opposed it as well, asserting that it would be good for diplomacy, post-war diplomacy, if Israel were, and these are his words, I quote, "bleed a little." Bleed a little means let more Jews die. And Kissinger's always been so duplicitous that he denied this to Ambassador Simcha Dinitz, even claimed to Dinitz there was a false rumor circulating that Kissinger had kept Israel from preempting. I'll read you the text, because all these things are now declassified. Kissinger, it's absolutely essential also that senators and congressmen don't go around attacking the president. Ribbikoff called me to say there's a story going around that I kept you from preempting. Dinitz, that's ridiculous. Kissinger, well, because he had to say that. He needed the arms. Kissinger, that is the story that is going around. They say I kept you from preempting. Dinitz, I know the source. I'll handle it. Now, that's in direct conflict with Kissinger's own words in the classified memorandum from the day the war started, warning them against any preemptive attack. So, that's what we call a lie. Now, the best evidence is that Kissinger stalled and stalled until Nixon overruled him and the Pentagon and ordered, and these were his words, send everything that can fly to Israel immediately. And even then, most European countries, NATO allies, all socialists like Golda Meir refused to allow the American transport planes to land in their countries for refueling, for which Golda Meir severely chastised them at the next Socialist International Conference, as if they cared. Portugal opened the Azores to American flights within 10 days. Beginning in the second week of the war, almost 28,000 tons of American weapons made their way to Israel. I'll note one thing. I remember from the time, and someone reminded me today, if you look at Bilam's bracha, this came out around the war, but I remember hearing before the war, in Bilam's bracha, Parshas Balak, Perek Chof Dalid, Pasuk Yud Ches, the Pasuk ends, V'Yisrael Osechoyil, Bilam said, the Jewish people will attain strength, might, prosperity. If you look at the Targum on V'Yisrael Osechoyil is, V'Yisrael Yatzlach B'Nichsen. All right? Israel will succeed with Nixon. All right? I remember hearing that back then. Now, immediately, Kissinger, look it up for yourself. Chaf Dalet Pasuk Yud Ches. Immediately, Kissinger began to cover for himself and claim credit for sending the airlift, but Golda Meir knew better, and she blamed Kissinger for the delay, and she credited Richard Nixon. I'll never forget that if it hadn't been for Nixon, we would have been destroyed. And even Nixon conceded that years later. It was probably his finest hour when Nixon visited Israel in June 1974, 2 months before he had to resign. He received a hero's welcome. Meanwhile, Kissinger began a shuttle diplomacy that would coerce Israel into freeing the trapped Egyptian Third Army in exchange for nothing, and begin gradual withdrawals from Egypt, the Canal Zone, and then from Sinai and in Syria. Nonetheless, in retribution, the Arabs embargoed oil, and the United States for the first time confronted gasoline shortages and rationing. Jew haters blamed the Jews, but Nixon also paid a price for that. And now we come to the end and to Watergate. By the time the Yom Kippur War was being fought, Nixon was desperately trying to hang on to his office in the wake of one of the most bizarre events in American history. So we know Nixon was always insecure. He was too obsessed with who's getting credit for what. Reagan had a sign, which, by the way, we now have hanging in our office here, that it's amazing how much can be accomplished if no one cares who gets the credit for it. I'm not so sure what the relevance of the office is, but nonetheless, Nixon was the exact opposite. He was always worried about how he's being portrayed in the media. Kissinger's getting too much credit for things. He would again play one aide off the other to compete for his approval. Kissinger quoted Bismarck, what Bismarck called manipulating their antagonisms. That's how you deal with underlings. And he's always jealous of Kissinger. Nixon basically self-destructed. When he became president, he removed Johnson's taping system. And then he had a new one installed in 1971 that was voice-activated, not switch-activated, because he was notoriously clumsy. And like I said, he suffered from the new media that showed no deference to the president, and especially not to this president. And the tapes exposed the seamier side of politics that had always existed, but that no one had ever heard before. No one could ever imagine such things took place, and Nixon's public standing plummeted. The truth is, there's not a shred of evidence that he knew in advance about the break-in at the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, and not a shred of evidence that he knew in advance about the Watergate burglary. But there was a culture of black ops that existed in every administration, going back to FDR. This was routine. Presidents felt, they didn't feel they were above the law. They felt they were the law. And in fact, Nixon, years later, in the David Frost interview, said these words. I remember watching it and then reading it this past week. He said, if the president does it, by definition, it's not illegal. And he believed that because that's how he grew up and that's what he saw in Washington the whole time. And so it was in his administration, and it was also unnecessary in context. In 1972, Nixon swept to victory an unprecedented landslide, defeating the far-left George McGovern, who, by the way, I came across this week, say something positive about that character. He was an army bomber during World War II, and he verified, he flew a number of missions right over Auschwitz in 1944, and he said he could have dropped bombs, they were just told not to bomb there. They were bombing areas around Auschwitz, but not the death camp or the concentration camp. So to say it was not doable, he says, completely false. He remembers flying over it. All the dirty tricks that were done because that's what Johnson had done. That's what Kennedy had done, if not worse. The earliest dirty trickster was Dick Tuck. He was a JFK operative. And I mean, it's comical in retrospect, the things they would do. Order like 1,000 pizzas and send them collect to the Nixon campaign, all right? He pretended to be a Republican operative in 1960 and then booked a tremendous hall at their expense. And of course, it was empty. So Kennedy would show up to an empty hall. But this is the way politics was practiced. Nixon got caught in a tsunami of change in American society. He was hurt by an aggressive press and a partisan Congress. And to show you how the old generation could not relate, Johnson was in failing health in late 1972. Billy Graham went to visit him, asked about Watergate, and LBJ laughed. And he said, that's not going to hurt him one bit. You see how someone who held the office, who practiced the politics of the office as it had always been practiced, just could not identify with the change in the culture. To date, no one knows for sure what they were looking for in the Democratic National Committee offices in the Watergate building. Even the bugs they placed didn't work, but the tapes destroyed him, even if he maintained, and not without some justification, that they did not prove his guilt in anything. For example, in the smoking gun tape, which is a smoking gun, June 23rd, 1977, I think 6 days after the break-in, he found out about a day or two before then, he agreed that administration officials should have the CIA ask L. Patrick Gray, who was the acting director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover died just a month before, May 1972, the CIA asked the FBI to stop their investigation into the Watergate burglary on national security grounds. So to the prosecutors, that was a conspiracy to obstruct justice. And that's what sunk Nixon. But Nixon, on these tapes, was always spouting off about something. Always making outrageous, illegal demands. Fire these people. Bomb there. Let the IRS do this. Disrupt this. Send in the tricksters here. And his staff knew to ignore 90% of what he said or wrote, and in which even he never followed up on. He always let off steam. So in fact, he said this. Did he have intention to obstruct justice? Who knows? But did the CIA ever tell the FBI not to investigate? No. In fact, Nixon in July personally told Patrick Gray, Pat, you just continue to conduct your aggressive and thorough investigation, which he did. But the media, especially the Washington Post, hated Nixon, and it was mutual. They persisted, or abetted by a deep throat, now revealed to be Mark Felt, who was second in command at the FBI, and he was angry that he was passed over for the top job after Hoover died. He wasn't doing this for moral reasons. He was just bitter. If J. Edgar Hoover had lived, Watergate would have disappeared. If Nixon had burned the tapes, Watergate would have disappeared. Now, he said he thought about it, but he never thought the tapes were that incriminating, because he was always talking in these grandiose ways. For example, the Obama IRS scandal disappeared because all the emails were destroyed. Like the Hillary Clinton's emails were destroyed. There's nothing to investigate. Nixon himself was taped as saying July 19th, 1972, a month after Watergate, I quote, "I've been through these. The worst thing a guy can do, the worst thing, there are two things, each is bad. One is to lie, and the other one is to cover up." He never thought he was covering up. By the time of the Yom Kippur War, it was already finished. The Saturday Night Massacre, the special prosecutor was fired, attorney generals quit. That happened during the Yom Kippur War. Nixon was distracted, he was just twisting slowly in the wind, incredulous as to how everything was coming apart around him and just trying to hold on. And the Jews piled on against Nixon as well. One of the lead Post reporters was Carl Bernstein. And of course, the liberal Jews all attacked Nixon vigorously. One of Nixon's most prominent defenders was an interesting, colorful Jew named Rabbi Baruch Korf, who had never met Nixon before this, from Connecticut. He didn't vote for Nixon in 68. He just felt Nixon was being vilified unfairly. He met Nixon once in May 1974, and he formed on his own the National Citizens Committee for Fairness to the Presidency, an organization of one. I remember, actually, Baruch Korf. He always got a lot of publicity, but because he was countercultural, he was the rare Jew. Nixon turned him a source of strength, was most appreciative, called him my rabbi. Conversely, the Reform rabbi Alexander Schindler called him, Rabbi Korf, an apologist for rampant immorality. And this Baruch Korf died in 1995. By the end of July, the country had already been too exposed to the squalid nature of Nixon's Oval Office. A House committee recommended impeachment. He lost Republican support. He decided to resign. The world leaders to whom he had drawn near, Brezhnev, Mao Zedong, Zhou Enlai, they watched with bemusement, not understanding how such a thing could happen. August 8, 1974, Thursday night, Richard Nixon announced his resignation, effective the next day. He was succeeded by his vice president, Gerald Ford, who had been approved by Congress pursuant to the 25th Amendment, relatively new, after Vice President Spiro Agnew had resigned after being implicated in a bribery scandal, pleaded nulla contendere to a tax evasion charge. And American politics has never been the same. Nixon disappeared for a time. He was pardoned by Gerald Ford, which preempted any further investigation or trial. He almost died of a blood clot pretty soon after he left office. And then he began a long process of rehabilitation, became an acclaimed writer and thinker, wrote 10 books in retirement, a diplomat, advisor to Reagan, less so to Bush, more so to Bill Clinton. He moved to New York City, then here, lived in Upper Saddle River for a time, then in Park Ridge. You visit his library, you see it spares nothing, even about Watergate, and certainly not about his accomplishments in office. He died April 22, 1994, aged 81. But from his notes after Chappaquiddick, a subtle message to Ted Kennedy, but something he in essence repeated when he left office, and it's really the epitaph of his own life. I quote, these are his notes, "Defeat doesn't finish a man, quit does. A man is not finished when he's defeated, he's finished when he quits." Nixon's relations with Jews were troubled, but when Israel was threatened, he personally intervened in a dramatic way, and for that we owe him a debt of gratitude. His two successors would bully Israel much more than did this most maligned president. I thank you all very much. Next week, we'll look at the presidencies of Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter. I thank you all.